Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Suicide is a topic that hides in the shadows. It's time we talk away the dark, learn how to spot the warning signs for suicide, and how you can have an open, caring, real conversation to help save lives. Visit the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention to watch the new short film and learn more at afsp.org/talkawaythedark.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Happy Friday. Time to look back at the last 7 days and make sense of the biggest local and state stories in our weekly news recap. From a university working with pro-Palestinian student activists.
Protesters agreed to tear down their encampments. And in exchange, Northwestern is promising to bring two visiting Palestinian faculty members to campus and offer 5 scholarships to Palestinian students.
To a plan to lower the speed limit in Chicago.
It would go from 30 miles per hour in residential areas down to 25.
To possibly the CTA, Metra, and Pace joining forces.
A new bill in Springfield is aiming to overhaul Chicago's public transit system as the city's bus and rail agencies face a looming budget crisis.
To discuss those stories and more, I sat down with Axios Chicago reporter Monica Eng, WBEZ city government and politics reporter Mariah Wolfel, and Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Ray Long. We started with the pro-Palestinian protests happening in college campuses in Chicago. Monica, what's the latest? Where are we seeing the biggest actions and encampments?
The encampments came down at Northwestern this week, but we're still seeing action there as some Jewish groups are calling for the resignation of President Michael Schill because of what they saw as concessions and capitulation to the protesters of things like some Palestinian faculty and some undergraduate scholarships for Palestinian students and more transparency around investments. On the same day that those encampments were supposed to come down, U of C launched encampments. This morning, I'm told the mayor and Superintendent Larry Snelling have been asked about whether or not Chicago police may be brought in to take down those U of C encampments, which the president is calling for taking down. DePaul, their encampments are still up and growing. I visited a couple days ago. And we saw this move into CPS high schools on decision day when a lot of students were going to be saying, hey, I'm going to University of Michigan or U of I. Or, a lot of students decided instead to have a sit-in at least Jones College Prep.
Yeah. And we'll get into the high school movement in just a moment. I want to hear a little bit of what you were talking about a moment ago, some of the local student protesters who are demonstrating this week. We've got sound from the University of Chicago. And here's an a cappella group from Northwestern. So organizers reached a deal with administration at Northwestern, as you pointed out, but at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, police did arrest 2 people. On some other campuses around the country, we've seen student activists take over buildings, and we've also seen, at this point, more than 2,000 arrests across the country. People have probably seen images of what was going on at Columbia University in New York and USC. It's been a little bit more subdued and peaceful here, I think, Mariah. I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, so I haven't been to any of the encampments, but have been reading the coverage, and it sounds kind of like that tape from what I've read. Peaceful protest, students, you know, laid out on the lawn, reading, chanting, and kind of just convening around these tents at the UChicago encampment, which I'll talk about. I think that'll be what people are watching today as the university president has ordered that the encampment must come down. As Monica said, it's unclear if CPD will take part in that, but, you know, students at Northwestern, DePaul, and UChicago have reported that things have been peaceful, but there is this lingering fear that that could change either with counter protests or with, you know, police presence. And so that's going to be a big question today as We see what happens. Right. University of Chicago students have reached an impasse with administrators. Students have been asking for, you know, acknowledgement of genocide in Gaza. They've asked for transparency around the money that the university gives to arms dealers, and they've asked for divestment from Israel. And so those are some of the demands that they've reached an impasse about, and now, you know, President is saying those encampments must come down. And so I think that'll be kind of a big question today of whether things will still be able to remain as peaceful as they have been.
What do you think about all this, Ray?
It strikes me that bringing in the police to break up college campus encampments is on the verge of being over the top. And if you want to irritate the situation and stir the pot, that would be the thing that does it, as we saw in Colombia. And then it also strikes me that this is not the time to be stirring the pot if you're in Chicago here, because it's just a warm-up act for the Democratic National Convention in August. And everybody is on their toes now, fearing that it could be 68 all over again.
Local Jewish leaders held a press conference Wednesday criticizing the strategies Northwestern has used to keep the peace. Tell us more about what they had to say, Monica.
Well, I interviewed one of the officials from the JUF, Jane Charney, and I tried to understand what the press conference was about. And there were several elders, I believe, Raymond Lopez and Debbie Silverstein and Conway.
Nick Spazzato.
And they felt like these demonstrations were being done to harass and isolate Jewish students. I asked, do you feel like any of these protesters are there because they're mourning or concerned about civilian deaths and casualties in Palestine? And she said, I believe the vast majority are there to isolate and harass Jewish students, or to be in the in crowd. And she said, quote, the in crowd are anti-Semites. And so I was like, okay, well, I just want to be sure that that's the message. And that was the message.
On some campuses, the media, including student journalists, they've been kept from the protesters. At Columbia, reporters from the campus radio station say that they were threatened with arrest if they left the journalism building to cover the raid. So I want to get all your thoughts on this and how it impacts the tension on the campuses. You first, Mariah.
Yeah, I mean, well, to Ray's point that I think sometimes the response to what start out and continue to be largely peaceful protests tends to escalate them. And that can be seen as, you know, bringing in police to tear down these encampments without clear and very well-defined safety threats, instead of just allowing students to continue to convene. You know, maybe the image of tents on a campus isn't ideal, but without a clear and imminent safety threat, it seems to escalate. And I think that can be said the same about limiting press, including student reporters, to a room. You know, student reporters on WKCFR, I can't remember the call letters, but they have been broadcasting live from their student journalism building, and it's just been remarkable because they've been they've had to report through windows of just what they were seeing out on their campus. Even professional media were limited to a specific area. And these student journalists, I mean, I tweeted about this, the pressure that you could hear in their voices was just heartbreaking. You know, one student was saying, I haven't slept in 40 hours. You know, before that, they said, we can't go off air, because if we go off air, who's going to be documenting what's going on right now?
And the station's WKCR.
Thank you. That pressure just continues to cook as more reporters, professional reporters who, you know, should be carrying that burden are also limited from covering these protests. And we're here talking on World Press Freedom Day. And it is disturbing to see students, you know, limited or threatened with potential arrest for documenting what's going on their campus, on protests of a war that we have seen kill you know, more than 100 journalists and media reporters. And so, I mean, those are really my only thoughts on that, is that it to me as a reporter personally, it's sad to see.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was watching all of it erupt in real time that night. Monica, you too?
I should say at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, a lot of the encampments are around the alma mater, and the university shut off the alma mater cam. And it's this iconic statue. And so the Daily Illini, which has been seeing some really tough times lately, the student newspaper, put a 24-hour cam on there. And they're really seeing a surge in kids reading the school paper again because of this coverage.
Oh, my goodness. Ray?
Well, it's outrageous that any kind of attempt is made by any college professor or academic administration person to try to hold down the coverage of this. They talk about their free speech rights, and then they don't want to give free speech rights to people who actually are professionals at free speech and writing about truth. It's outrageous. They should get back and get out of their ivory tower and maybe just cut loose their journalism departments if they don't want to abide by reality.
Retweet. I agree.
Man.
The head of the Medill
Plus
School.
One.
I was just at an event with the head of the Medill School of Journalism last week, and he in a public event, decried the university's policy to not let the press in.
Great. Do something else. You know, maybe threaten to dislodge the Medill School of Journalism or something like that. You got to open up the communication here. You can't have things build up in a pressure cooker and then expect everything to be twisted the way you want it to be twisted. You want to let people in to tell the truth. That's what we do. That's what they should be doing.
Absolutely. Well, on Monday, we're going to be talking to student journalists from some local universities here on Reset. We want to hear from them what it's been like to cover these protests on their campuses.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Now, college students weren't the only ones protesting this week. Monica, as you alluded to earlier, high schoolers have joined in.
Yeah, Jones College Prep had a sit-in, and the media showed up, and there was paper all over the windows, and so we had to get reports from the students who said about 100 kids participated. At the very same time, there was a press conference by parents of some CPS high schools who were concerned that the narrative that was being presented at these sit-ins was not accurate.
Mm. Interesting. You heard from one Jewish parent, though, who was outside where the students held that sit-in. What did she say to you?
She didn't feel like her Jewish student child was comfortable in that setting. And that is also what those who held the counter event felt. They said that these protests are, isolating and harassing Jewish students. And they didn't feel like these were ceasefire protests or solidarity with civilians who've been affected. They felt like it was more about anti-Semitism. And with these sides so far apart, I'm not seeing a lot of hope of bringing them together, because the characterization of these protests is so different from the opposite sides.
Any idea what the Chicago Public Schools policy is on student protests, Monica?
I believe they allow it for 30 minutes. And that's how long this went.
Okay.
And, you know, the kids chose this day because they said that when you're choosing your college, you should consider a college and what its policies are. I just hope that there can be some sort of talks where they can come together and find common ground, because it's so divided. And the biggest violence we have seen across the country is when counter-protesters and protesters come into close proximity. I feel like that may be the most potential for conflict.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, Ray, because people are comparing today's student activism to what the country experienced during the 60s when, you know, young people protested the Vietnam War. And we had a chaotic and pretty violent 1968 DNC here in our city. What do you think of that comparison?
Well, I just think it's a warm-up act. If they allow, if there's too much of a crackdown, if there's too much of an effort to try to contain things, including the efforts here to contain or not give permits to basic demonstrations here in Chicago, I think that just creates a pressure cooker that it could very well explode. Mm. I think there has to be a lot of thoughtfulness and a lot of attempt to try to give everybody a chance to say their voice. Once you try to contain it, it will really backfire, or it has the potential to backfire.
You say it could very well explode. I mean, are we ready for an explosion? Are we prepared?
We went through one in 1996, and this is not 1996. That one went well, but protesters were not as fired up as they are in this country about everything from the activities in Israel and Gaza to Ukraine. But it is more similar probably to the reaction to Vietnam, although obviously we aren't sending troops over there right now too. But there are concerns just about innocent people getting killed and at every battlefront. And that's what a lot of people are protesting.
Well, speaking of the DNC, two groups filed lawsuits against the city for being denied permits to protest near the convention. Mariah, can you fill us in?
So the city wants to, you know, limit protests to an area near Grant Park, and activists from a spectrum of issues, pro-Palestinian issues, LGBTQ plus issues, they are saying that is not close enough to have the audience that we want, which are, you know, dozens and dozens of politically and civically engaged people, politicians convening at the United Center in McCormick Place, as well as journalists who are going to be covering the convention where it is. You know, the point of protest is to drum up energy and, you know, an audience and to get coverage in the media. And so protesters have said, we want to be within sight and sound of where the action is and not, you know, siphoned off to an area that's blocks away from from where this is going on. The city has said that there will be a security perimeter around the United Center, but hasn't said how far that security perimeter will be, and has also said that protesters will not be allowed in that area. And they've denied every permit that has requested permission. But, you know, I mean, when it comes down to it, I think that there will be many groups who don't abide by those permits and will practice their right to free speech with or without a permit. I mean, we'll see what happens as lawsuits play out.
And this, so far, this lawsuit is from the ACLU and the U.S. Palestinian Community Network. So the ACLU, Monica, saying, we're not prepared. We're not prepared at all. I mean, do you think they have a point?
Well, I mean, whenever we ask about security perimeters and things, they say, you know, these are not secrets that we can be giving out. Secret Service has been on the ground since Chicago was announced as the DNC city. I think from just what we've been seeing and then the protests we've been seeing, the protest that blocked people's access to O'Hare, the protest that happens pretty much at any DNC type of event. I was at one at the Hideout where there were plants in the audience. They jumped up on stage with Palestinian flags. I think if that's any prelude, we are going to see a very strong protest movement. I was talking to a journalist the other day, and they said, hey, do you have your press passes for the DNC to get inside the United Center? I said, I think we all know what's going to happen inside the United Center. Mm-hmm. A lot of the news is going to be outside.
Outside, for sure. Speaking of security and police presence, WBEZ and the Sun-Times published a big story last night. Police Superintendent Larry Snelling revealed yesterday that he won't be punishing any of the 9 officers whose names were leaked as members of the extremist anti-government group called the Oath Keepers. Details, Mariah?
CPD says it conducted an internal investigation and that the claims were unsubstantiated, and Oath Keepers' membership list was leaked, and the Sun-Times and WBEZ did a big investigation called Extremism Among the Ranks, in the ranks, and found that 27 Chicago police officers were on that list. 9 of them were active police officers. You know, Larry Snelling at the time of that investigation had said something along the lines of there's zero tolerance for extremism in our ranks, and had, you know, all but committed to rooting out, you know, officers who were linked to extremist groups. Oath Keepers, of course, has ties to the January 6th insurrection. But Mayor Brandon Johnson and Larry Snelling seem to be singing a much different tune today. Mayor Brandon Johnson said he's still committed to his campaign promise to root out extremism, but and if an investigation were to have proven ties, then he would be willing to get rid of those officers, but that he trusts the CPD process. Chicago's Inspector General says she's going to review and comb through that investigation, and if she needs to make a recommendation that they, go in the opposite direction, she will. But as it stands, those nine officers are not facing discipline. Those nine officers, were on the Oath Keepers list, and the investigation by Dan Mihalopoulos and Tom Shuba also showed that they had some troubling misconduct history within the police department.
Right.
So as of right now, they stand where they stand, and we'll see what happens with the Inspector General's investigation.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to Springfield. Lawmakers were in session this week. Among a whole host of topics, they talked through a bold plan to merge the Chicago area's three public transit agencies, the CTA, Metra, and PACE. Monica, what's behind this effort?
Well, they believe that it'll avoid duplication, different bureaucracies kind of doing the same thing. They also, one thing that I kind of liked was if you just pay one fare, you can also get on Metra and you can get on PACE and CTA. You don't have to keep paying duplicate fares. They also say that it will help sort of centralize everything and really, bring us into the 20th century and get $1.5 billion more in funding, much needed funding, as we head toward fiscal cliffs for a lot of these agencies. Whether Chicago wants to lose its grip on the CTA that it's running so beautifully and nobody has any complaints about it.
No complaints whatsoever.
Is another question. They want it to all be ruled by this Metropolitan Mobility Authority, the MMA, which is not mixed martial arts, but it could turn into that if people are not happy with this.
Ray, what do you think? Do you think this transit merger plan is going to get the green light or stall?
Ooh,
nice.
Man, transition. I think part of this will go back to individual turfs, because they will have suburbanites who have consistently tried to have control over patronage in their areas where transit goes, and Chicago, who has tried to control their areas. We can recall just not too long ago that then House Speaker Michael Madigan was caught up in a big Metra scandal because he was trying to put some of his people in better position there. And that all just showed how the political influence is in there. If they can get over that and do some kind of coordinated effort, I think it would be to the benefit of everybody. Just not too long ago, also in Springfield, they had trouble just putting together a universal fare pass, too. So it's one of these things that probably should be done for the efficiency sake and for the cost savings, but the politics and all of the internal fighting will be what makes the difference.
Meanwhile, CTA President Dorval Carter seems to have come under a lot of criticism. Does he still have Mayor Johnson's support, Mariah?
Well, I don't think Mayor Johnson has been, vehemently supportive of Dorval Carter. But if you look at the actions, Johnson is coming up on a year in office and Dorval Carter still leads the CTA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you can read that as Mayor Johnson's full support of Dorval Carter. I think we'll see what happens as this effort to take control of the CTA away from Chicago moves forward. But I think one of Johnson's latest comments is kind of telling, where Governor J.B. Pritzker came out and said, he's concerned about the CTA, and when deciding, whether the CTA should get more state funding, Pritzker would would potentially require a change in leadership at the transit authority. And Johnson didn't name Pritzker directly, but said, basically, I appoint the CTA head. You know, it's voted on by the CTA board, but that's under my control. And if someone wants to change that, they can run for mayor, which was a very snarky comment to make against the governor. But so I do think that we have his full support, which is somewhat perplexing. You know, Johnson was very critical of the CTA's performance on the campaign trail. That performance hasn't really improved as far as I can tell and what we hear from readers. And so you'd think it would be like a pretty easy political win for Johnson, who probably needs it right now, to replace leadership at the CTA. But so far, we haven't seen action in that direction.
Well, Governor Pritzker's nonprofit Think Big America also made headlines this week with a $500,000 donation in support of a ballot initiative that guarantees abortion rights in Florida. Details on that, Monica?
Yeah, this is one of a few donations his foundation has given to states where abortion was going to be on the ballot. And it seems kind of where Governor Pritzker is like staking his claim that he wants to secure a woman's right to choose in states across this. And, you know, he knows that this is an issue that is going to bring out a lot of female voters. And anywhere this is on the ballot, it's going to bring out Democrats. It's going to bring out female
I mean,
voters.
He's really throwing his full support behind the pro-choice efforts nationally, isn't he?
It's easy. He's really making this his issue on a national level. And the Democratic Party, more broadly, feels like this is an issue where they can win. And if it gets on the November ballot, it's going to bring women and Democrats out in droves.
Ray, I want to stick with J.B. Pritzker for a moment because one thing he hasn't been on board with is the Chicago Bears plan for a new stadium. But on Wednesday, Bears executives had their first substantial meeting with his team. They didn't get a warm reception, though, did they?
No. The aides that met with the Bears, and not the governor, but the governor's aides met with the Bears, and they came out with the conclusion that the current structure as proposed by the Bears is a non-starter. The Bears are willing to put up $2 billion in private funds. They think they can get another $300 million from the NFL. They think that they could get another $900 million in borrowing from the sports facility, the Illinois sports facility. And it's kind of unclear, though the mayor is supportive, it's kind of unclear where he would get $1.5 billion to fancy up the place a little bit, maybe put a hotel out there in this whole new complex, too. There's still hundreds of millions of dollars owed on reconstructing Soldier Field and Guaranteed Rate Field. So they have to refinance some of that, repay some of that, stretch out the loan payments. You know, this isn't going to get done before the end of the legislative session. They want to get through their election before they make any big deals.
Which is, I mean, in a couple of weeks, the end of the legislative session. So on the other hand, though, I mean, the Bears call that meeting productive.
Well,
like, were they in the same room?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's spin.
it's like in Dumb and Dumber. So what you're saying is there's a chance.
So what you're saying, there's a chance.
Well, that's a great comparison, actually. They got to come out and they're not going to say, oh, no, we're done. We're duped. We were beat over the head. But the reality is they got to come up with some different plan here. It wasn't that long ago that they just redid this whole Soldier Field thing. I was down there then, and, you know, we were just, as Bears fans, we were just hoping that Rashawn Salaam would get another couple extra yards on each play. Mm-hmm. And they finally got it through, and it's puzzling because it's still a stadium that is in fairly decent shape, and so is Guaranteed Rate Field, and they want to put a new stadium out in the South Loop, and the whole equation is mind-numbing, and I can't see that Springfield gets to it anytime soon.
So, Monica, you think there's a chance?
Well, clearly the Bears think there is. And, you know, maybe this is all poker and they're playing the long game and they're making being a hard person to pursue. But, boy, Pritzker doesn't seem excited about it. Springfield doesn't seem excited. And, you know, I think a lot of people have questioned whether this is a progressive thing to give billions to an NFL franchise when they would love to see schools and mental health centers and grocery stores in their neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So,
Well, looking back at Mayor Johnson, Mariah, I mean, he's been enthusiastic about the Bears' Lakefront Stadium plan. So what kind of reaction has he been getting for his support of the team?
I think it's perplexing to some because on the campaign trail, you know, Mayor Brandon Johnson was asked specifically, should the city put up $2 billion or more to help keep the Bears in Chicago? And now this plan doesn't call for the city putting up that money, but it certainly does call, if you do the math, for $2.4 billion in public financing in one way or another. There's $900 million in bonds and then $1.5 billion in a mystery revenue source, but not private money from the Bears, at least. And that's, you know, the city says going to come from state and federal funding. You could get federal transportation grants to improve transportation around Soldier Field, which are some of the infrastructure needs. So while he's not, it's not an exact one-to-one flip-flop because the city wouldn't be funding this, Mayor Johnson is sitting here saying, like, I want to use some of my political capital to try to get state and federal funding to the tune of $1.5 billion to fund this, you know, private stadium. You know, he's actually painting this as a point of pride for himself. He had kind of an interesting quote with NBC Sports Chicago where he said, if you would have told me a decade ago that I would have the opportunity to stand with billionaires, which is surprising coming from a grassroots organizer, paid organizer for the CTU.
Right.
But he says that the opportunity that he's identifying is what he sees as him pushing and strong arming the Bears into putting up $2 billion in private funding. He's saying, like, I was the guy who came in and made them put skin in the game. And, you know, it's going to increase green space. You know, Chicago Public Schools is going to be able to use this private stadium. But it's a question of whether that message is going to resonate with his progressive base, many of which were kind of perplexed. Yeah. And, you know, progressive lawmakers who say, like, you know, we need our political capital at the federal level to fight for more migrant funding and at the state level to fight for more funding for schools. And we shouldn't be, you know, focused on this. So, you know, we'll see how that
interesting.
Plays out.
Monica, you have a thought?
I was at a restaurant opening earlier this week and I saw a very powerful alderman who is an ally of the mayor's. And I said, do you think the mayor should have had more of a poker face when he was up on stage and not been more so much of a cheerleader for this? And the alder just looked at me with a straight face. You think he didn't have a poker face? And then I got a 180. It's like, I need to go talk to someone else at this party, Monica. I can't keep talking to you.
They're out of there.
Well, I can guess who that was.
Well, on the same tune of what you were talking about there, Mariah, the mayor's also busy coming up with ways to use hundreds of millions of dollars in federal COVID relief money from the American Rescue Plan Act before this 2026 deadline. What's he saying he wants to do with that money?
Yeah, so, I mean, here's the deal. When the city got this money in 2021, federal COVID-19 relief money, they put a bunch of it, the majority of it, towards city operating expenses. 1.3 out of 1.9 billion just went to, like, general operating expenses. But 600 million was earmarked for community initiatives that address mental health, homelessness prevention. It paid for the guaranteed basic income pilot program that many people know about. But the city has been really, aside from those, you know, some programs here and there, the city has been really slow to spend that $600 million.
Right.
Only 35% of it has been spent. And only 59% of it has been so-called obligated, which is a legal term for basically, you know, like you've got a contract with an agency saying that you're going to spend these funds. And the city, by the end of this year, has to obligate 100% of those funds or they have to send that money back to the federal government and they have to spend it by 2026.
So they've decided to sort of narrow the focus.
Right. They've narrowed the focus. They're shifting priorities towards programs that have been easier to implement because the reason they say that they've been so slow to spend these funds, which, you know, mostly happened under Mayor Lori Lightfoot, former Mayor Lori Lightfoot, is because of red tape and city contracting, basically, or not enough, you know, community agencies to implement these programs. And so they took a look at the funding and, you know, where they want to spend those funds. And they said, all right, well, this program has been really hard to get an administrator or an agency to implement. We're going to nix that one and we're going to take the funding and put it towards, for instance, the Guaranteed Basic Income Program, which has been, you know, really easy to implement. So, yeah, the big news out of this whole reshift was they're going to do a second round of the GBI program.
The Guaranteed Basic Income program, which was very popular. Turning to Chicago City Council before we take a quick pause and sticking with you, Mariah, there's an alder that's trying to get the city's speed limit reduced from 30 to 25 miles per hour.
Yeah, this has the support of, you know, administration officials who say people are much less likely to be seriously injured or killed by cars that are going 25 miles per hour or under. Currently, you know, on city streets, the speed limit is 30 miles per hour. So this would reduce it to 25.
I mean, and this comes after a year of having seeing 134 fatal traffic crashes in Chicago.
Yeah. So, you know, advocacy groups and urban planners testified before a city council committee this week and largely endorsed the plan. It's going to face, I think, some stiff, you know, headwinds in the city council. We saw this fight play out under former Mayor Lori Lightfoot when she reduced the threshold for which Chicagoans can be ticketed from 10 miles per hour over the speed limit to 6 miles per hour. So currently the speed limit's 30, but if you're going 36, you get a speed ticket. You get a ticket instead of if you're going 40, you get a ticket. So
lots of tickets were issued when that change happened.
Yeah. So we'll see.
I was one of them.
Yeah.
And I'm better now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lori Lightfoot.
The city, you know, the opposition was, you know, saying like this should not be a cash grab by the city. But, you know, then there's people who support the lower threshold saying it's not a cash grab. It's a safety, you know, strategy.
Interesting.
So we'll see that debate play out.
Now, it wouldn't be the news recap without a little corruption talk, would it? This week, the spotlight's on convicted former alderman Ed Burke. He is set to be sentenced on 13 counts of bribery in late June. Leading up to that sentencing date, he's gathering letters of support, and one of those letters raised a few eyebrows. Ray, fill us in.
Yeah, it came from Paul Vallis, the guy who just lost the mayoral run here a year ago.
You have to categorize him as that. He's done a lot more than lose the mayoral election.
Well, yeah.
We're talking recently, though.
Yeah, okay, yeah. True.
He's made many runs and had many losses. He was also, he's a complex guy, truth is. I've known him for about 40 years from back when he was a budget guru down in Springfield. And he was obviously the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. And he's done many things around the country regarding schools. But he made the point in a letter calling for leniency for Ed Burke, that Ed Burke is a guy who was there and was very professional and treated him well and was the kind of professional alderman that we should be looking up to here, and that he deserves leniency.
Yeah.
And
why don't I read a little bit of a quote here from that letter, Ray. It says, quote, "I honestly cannot recall a single time he ever questioned my judgment, asked me to back down from a politically risky decision or for any consideration or favor. In short, Ed was a true professional whom I always felt met my standards for ethics," end quote.
Yeah, Ed Burke himself is a puzzle, right? He could play the big guy who could go out to big parties and rub elbows with important people and go to the Union League Club and have a good time with high rollers, and also go to the Union League Club and try to push some of his business onto a guy who was just trying to get his Burger King rolling out in Burke's ward. So it is a guy who could turn it on and off, as we saw with all the tapes. Mariah and I sat through that in the courtroom.
Oh, I remember.
So it was surprising, but yet it's not surprising with Vallis either, because he's a guy who's not afraid to say what he said.
Well, you said yourself,
what he thinks.
He's the former budget director.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that he'd be okay with that.
Yeah, and Burke, of course, was a longtime finance chairman.
Monica, what do you think?
I think that we're seeing lots of different sides of Paul Vallis, and I guess, you know, I wasn't totally surprised to hear that he supported Ed Burke. They seem to come from the same generation of City Hall and city politicos.
So that's back when it worked, too.
And yeah.
Richard Mayer Daley, you know, I mean, Vallis was a key part of getting some of those big daily budgets adopted, too.
Yeah. For those of us who might not remember, Mariah, just remind us what the former alderman was convicted of, Burke.
Yeah, so Burke was convicted in, you know, schemes relating to development of a Binney's Beverage Depot, a Burger King in his ward, and the old post office in Chicago, in which Burke tried to strong arm the developers of those projects into hiring his private property tax appeals firm, Clafter and Burke, and then also a scheme related to the Field Museum, where Burke tried to potentially block a fee increase at the Field Museum because leaders there didn't get back to his goddaughter about a potential internship. And, you know, I think that that scheme, as Ray was saying, did paint like the two sides of Burke in the tapes that we heard, because you can hear Burke kind of stripping down a Field Museum employee in harsh tones for not calling his goddaughter back, kind of questioning her credentials and, you know, saying like, where did you work before this? Do you read your news clips, like those sorts of things.
It's all coming back to you now, isn't it, Ray?
Yeah, I'm surprised I could even recall that from my memory. But then also really charming tapes, too, where he's making small talk with people. So you see those two sides of Burke. So I don't think it's surprising. And this is the first batch of letters. We might see more. I don't think it's surprising that there will be people coming out of the woodwork saying Burke and, you know, his wife, retired Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke, they're great people. They're gracious, because that was the reputation Burke had, but also the reputation of being very intimidating behind closed doors or on privately, you know, phone calls that were tapped by the federal government.
Let's turn to a media story, Ray. The Chicago Tribune joined several newspapers in suing Microsoft and OpenAI. This is for using copyrighted material. Any more details you can share?
Well, first of all, as you know, I'm not a big fan of the hedge fund overlords that the Tribune has, but they do know how to squeeze money out of people, including reporters who they don't pay, but don't pay well anyway, or give raises to.
Tell us how you really feel, Ray.
I'm snapping in support.
But the reality is that Microsoft and OpenAI is the target of the Tribune and other newspapers' lawsuit, because they say, and you got to believe that they have a high degree of truth in this, that these aggregators throw together artificial intelligence and come up with ways to generate ideas by scooping up all of the reporting that's been done in various newspapers. And the newspapers are saying, hey, wait a minute, you are not giving us anything for all of our work that we've spent literally billions of dollars trying to go out, smoke out stories and write them up. And then they just take it like it's a piece of air and don't give any return to the papers. So the papers are saying that, hey, you know, we should have a piece of this. You shouldn't just be able to violate our copyright willy-nilly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I want to take us to some good news now, Monica, after all of that. There's good news for downtown Chicago, I hear.
Yeah, it looks like our visitor traffic has increased by 35.5% year-over-year. From February to the previous February.
People are really coming.
People are really coming, but we were lagging before. So the increase from year-over-year, you know, it shows that we were behind and we're catching up. But also, it was recently reported by the Loop Alliance that we've seen record numbers, you know, of people coming on weekends. It surpassed pre-pandemic levels of people visiting the Loop. Weekday, still down. And, you know, occupancy on the Mag Mile, still down.
Yeah.
But
not surprising.
We're seeing some good numbers.
Yeah. Among all those other visitors downtown, we just found out Comedy Central's Daily Show will be here for the DNC. No word yet on the venue or who's going to be hosting that. And of course, Late Night with Stephen Colbert also announced a few weeks ago that they're going to be broadcasting from the Auditorium Theater during the convention. So a lot of excitement in August. Before we go, I've got about a minute and a half here, folks. Any stories that you want to promote that you'll be working on next week?
I've got a super exciting story about why those, you know, those little helicopters that come down from your maple trees, they're called Samaras.
Okay.
This year, a ton of them in Chicago and across the suburbs are pink. They're usually green and beige. And people are seeing these gorgeous pink. pink Samaras on the ground. So the headline is, why I'm seeing pink helicopters in Chicago.
Lisa Laba says the Barbie effect.
I'm getting lots and lots of theories.
Right.
But I'm talking to tree scientists, many of whom are stumped,
ooh,
pun intended, but a few who have some ideas.
That's interesting stuff. Yeah. What about you, Ray?
I was following her Instagram put out.
I saw the
social media that you were doing there. And, I've got an exciting story, too, but I'm not going to tell you about it.
Well, we'll just have to tune in. Mariah?
Well, way to branch out with that reporting.
Ooh, nice.
Oh, my gosh.
Take it to us.
I'm working on stories about Mayor Brandon Johnson's one-year anniversary, which is coming up in a couple of weeks here. And so,
time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also a committee meeting next week on aldermen to hear about the citywide strategy for youth employment this summer. This is a big priority of Mayor Brandon Johnson's, to double the One Summer Chicago program as one of his violence prevention efforts.
Yeah.
And so as we head into the summer months, which historically are more violent, we'll hear, in detail, a subject matter hearing on that plan on Monday.
Nice. So. We'll leave it there. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Mariah Wolfel from WBEZ, Monica Ng of Axios, and Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune. Have a good weekend, folks.
You too.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and Dan Tucker and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If you enjoyed today's recap, give us a rating or review wherever you're listening. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening and have a restful weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.